The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 4, Side 1.
A captured fugitive, if he was dead when taken, might be thrown near the camp mess hall to lie for several days with a rotting bullet wound, so the prisoners would value their thin gruel more highly. One taken alive might be set in front of the gatehouse, and whenever a column passed, they would set the dogs on him. And the dogs, depending on the command given, could suffocate a person, bite him, or merely tear his clothes off, leaving him naked. And one could also make a placard in the culture and educational section saying, "I escaped, but the dogs caught me." And this placard could be hung around the fugitive's neck, and he could be ordered to walk around the camp wearing it. And if he was beaten, then they had to burst his kidneys. If his hands were screwed into handcuffs, then it had to be done so that the feeling in his radial wrist joints would be lost for good. G. Sorokin, Ivdelag. Or if he was put into a punishment cell, he shouldn't come out without TB. Nero Blag, Baranov, Escape in 1944. After being beaten by the convoy, he coughed up blood, and 3 years later, they had to remove his left lung. And today, he is naively seeking to have his illness recognized as an occupational illness for the sake of his pension. How could it be more occupational, one would think, for both prisoner and convoy? Yet, they refuse to recognize it as such. Properly speaking, to beat the fugitive to within an inch of his life and to kill him were the principal forms of combating escapes in the archipelago. And it has become increasingly the principal form in the most recent Khrushchevian period as well. See Anatoly Marchenko's My Testimony. And even if no escapes occurred for a long time, then they sometimes had to be manufactured. At the Devin goldfields in the Kolyma in 1951, a group of Zeks was permitted to go out to gather berries. Three got lost and disappeared. The camp chief, Senior Lieutenant Pyotr Lomaga, sent torturers. They loosed their dogs on the three sleeping men, then smashed their skulls with the butts of their rifles until their heads were a mass of pulp and their brains hung out. And in that state, hauled them on a cart to the camp. Here the horse was replaced by four prisoners who had to drag the cart past the whole lineup. "That's how it will be for everybody," proclaimed Lomaga. And who can find inside himself the desperation to keep from shuddering in the face of all that, and go on, and go on, and go on, and arrive? But arrive where? There, at the end of the escape, when the fugitive attained his destined and designated goal, who was there who wouldn't be afraid to meet him, to hide him, to look after him? It was only the thieves who were awaited out in freedom at a prearranged hangout. For us 58s, such an apartment would be called a conspiratorial address, and that was nearly an underground organization. That is how many obstacles and pitfalls there were in the path of escape. But the desperate heart sometimes did not weigh things. It saw the river was flowing and a log was floating down it, and one jump will float on down. Vyacheslav Bezrodny from the Olchan camp, barely released from the hospital, still utterly weak, escaped down the Indigirka River on two logs fastened together, to the Arctic Ocean. Where was he going, and what was he hoping for? In the end, he was not so much caught as picked up on the open sea and returned over the winter road to Olchan to that very same hospital. It is not possible to say of everyone who didn't return to camp on his own, who was not brought in half alive, or who was not brought in dead, that he had escaped. Perhaps he had only exchanged an involuntary and long-drawn-out death in camp for the free death of a beast in the taiga. To the degree that the fugitives didn't so much escape as merely wander around and return on their own, the camp security chiefs even derived benefits from them. Without any strain, they would wrap another term around them, and if no escapes took place for a long time, they arranged provocations. Some stoolie or other was given in instructions to set up an escape group, and all of them would be arrested. but a man who seriously undertook to escape became very swiftly fearsome. Some of them set fire to the taiga behind them in order to get the dogs off their trail, and it would burn for weeks over dozens of miles. In 1949, on a meadow near the Veslianka State Farm, a fugitive was detained with human flesh in his knapsack. He had killed an unconvoyed artist with a 5-year term who had crossed his path, had cut his flesh off, and had not yet had the chance to cook it. In the spring of 1947, in the Kolyma near Elgin, two convoy guards were leading a column of Zeks. And suddenly, one Zek, without any prior agreement with anyone, skillfully attacked the convoy guards on his own, disarmed them, and shot them both. His name is unknown, but he turned out to have been a recent frontline officer, a rare and bright example of a frontline soldier who had not lost his courage in camp. The bold fellow announced to the column that it was free, but the prisoners were overwhelmed with horror. No one followed his lead, and they all sat down right there and waited for a new convoy. The frontline officer shamed them, but in vain. And then he took up the rifles, 32 cartridges, 31 for them, and left alone. He killed and wounded several pursuers, and with his 32nd cartridge, he shot himself. The entire archipelago might well have collapsed if all former frontliners had behaved as he did. In Kraslag, a former soldier, a hero of Kalkin Gol, attacked a convoy guard with an axe, stunned him with the butt, took his rifle and 30 cartridges. The dogs were sent after him. He killed two of them and wounded the dog trainer. When they caught him, they didn't just shoot him, but went crazy and avenged themselves and their dogs, riddling the corpse with their bayonets and leaving it to lie that way for a week by the gatehouse. In 1951, in that same Kraslag, some 10 long-termers were being convoyed by 4 infantrymen among the guards. Suddenly the Zeks attacked the convoy, took away their automatic weapons, put on their uniforms. But they had mercy on the soldiers. The oppressed were often more magnanimous than the oppressors. And 4 of them, convoying with braggadocio, conducted their comrades to the narrow-gauge railroad. There was an empty car there, ready for timber. The false convoy went up to the locomotive and forced the crew to disembark. One of them was a locomotive engineer. They drove the train at full speed to the Reshoti station on the trunk line of the Trans-Siberian. But they had about 40 miles to cover, and meanwhile they had already been reported, starting with the guards they had spared. Several times they had to shoot their way past groups of guards, and several miles before Reshoti, the authorities succeeded in mining the track in front of them, and put a battalion of camp guards into position. All the fugitives perished in the unequal battle. The quiet escapes were usually more fortunate in their results. Some of them were surprisingly successful. But we rarely hear of these happy stories. Those who broke out do not give interviews. They have changed their names, and they are in hiding. Kuzikovs-Kaczynski, who escaped successfully in 1942, tells the story now only because he was caught in 1959, after 17 years. Here is how he was discovered. The man who had fled with him got caught in another case. They managed to establish his true identity by his fingerprints. In this way, they discovered that the fugitive had not perished, as they had formerly supposed. They started to track down Kuzikov, too. For this, they conducted careful inquiries in his home region and put his relatives under surveillance. And through a chain of relatives, they got to him. And they spared neither effort nor time for all of this at 17 years remove. And we have learned of the successful escape of Zinaida Yakovlevna Povolyayeva, because in the end it fell through. She got her term because she had stayed on as a teacher in her school during the German occupation. But she was not immediately arrested when the Soviet armies arrived, and before her arrest she was married to a pilot. Then she was arrested and sent to mine number 8 at Forkuta. Through some Chinese working in the kitchen, she established communication with Freedom and with her husband. He was employed in civil aviation and arranged a trip to Forkuta for himself. On an appointed day, Zina went to the bath in the work zone, where she shed her camp clothing and released her hair, which had been curled the night before, from under her headscarf. Her husband was waiting for her in the work sector. There were security officers on duty at the river ferry, but they paid no attention to a girl with curly hair who was arm in arm with a flyer. They flew out on a plane. Zina spent 1 year living on false papers. But she couldn't resist the desire to see her mother again, and her mother was under surveillance. At her new interrogation, she managed to convince them she had escaped in a coal car, and they never did find out about her husband's participation. In 1946, Janice L. Blank S. walked from his camp in Perm to Latvia, speaking fractured Russian the whole way, and barely able to explain himself. His departure from camp was simple. He sprinted, broke through a rickety fence, and stepped over it. But later, in a swampy forest, with bast sandals on his feet, he had to live for a long time on berries alone. One day, he managed to take a village cow off into the woods and kill it. He ate his fill of beef and managed to make himself some primitive shoes from the cow's hide. In another place, he stole a sheepskin coat from a peasant. A fugitive to whom the inhabitants are hostile unwillingly becomes the inhabitant's enemy. In populated places, L. Blank S. claimed to be a Latvian conscript who had lost his documents. And although the universal inspection of passes had not yet been abolished that year, in Leningrad, which to him was a strange city, he managed, without uttering a word, to get to the Warsaw station and to walk another 2.5 miles along the tracks and board a train there. But there was one thing L. Blank S. was firmly assured of. When he got to Latvia, he would be fearlessly hidden. And that, of course, gave point to his escape. The kind of escape L. Blank S. undertook required a peasant's dexterity, grasp, and energy. But what about a city dweller? Yes, an old man at that, sentenced to 5 years for repeating an anecdote. Was he capable of escaping? It turns out that he was, when a more certain death was the only outcome of staying in his own camp, a small camp, between Moscow and Gorky, for non-political offenders on their last legs, which had been manufacturing shells since 1941. Well, 5 years was a child's term, you might say, but the unfortunate anecdote teller would not have lasted out even 5 months if he was driven out to work without being fed. This escape was a gesture of despair, a brief impulse, for which there would have been neither the judgment nor the strength 1/2 minute later. A routine train had been shunted into the camp and loaded with shells. And a convoy sergeant came marching along it, followed by a railroad man who had fallen several cars behind. The sergeant opened the door of each red cattle car and checked to be sure no one was in there, then shut the door, and the railroad man put a seal on it. And our ill-starred, famished last legger of an anecdote teller, all this happened in exactly this way, but his name has not been preserved, behind the back of the sergeant, who had gone on past and in front of the railroad man, scrambled into a car. It was not easy for him to clamber up, and it was not easy to push the door back noiselessly, and it was all very impractical. It was a sure failure, and he closed the door behind him with his heart skipping a beat. He was already sorry he had started. The sergeant would return and would kick him with his boots, and any moment now the railroad man would shout. Already someone was touching the door. It was the railroad man putting on the seal. And I myself think maybe the good railroad man saw him and pretended not to. The train moved off out of the compound. The train moved off to the front. This fugitive was unprepared. He didn't even have a piece of bread. In the course of 3 days, he would almost certainly die in this moving, voluntary punishment cell. He wouldn't get to the front, and it wasn't the fun he needed. What was he to do? How could he save himself now? He saw that the shell boxes were packed with a steel band around them. With his naked, defenseless hands, he tore that steel ribbon, and with it soared through the floor of the railroad car, in a place where there weren't any boxes. This was impossible for an old man, but was it possible to die? And if they opened it and caught him, was that possible? Furthermore, the boxes had wire loops attached to them, to carry them by. He cut off the loops, and out of them he made similar but much larger loops, and tied them so that they hung down through the cruel hole he had cut. How exhausted he was, how hard it was to get his torn hands to do what he wanted them to, how dearly that repeated anecdote was costing him. He didn't wait for a station, but carefully let himself down through the hole while the train was in motion, and lay with both feet in one loop nearer the rear of the train, and his shoulders in another. The train moved on, and the fugitive hung suspended there, rocking back and forth. The speed slackened, and at that moment he decided to let go. He dropped his feet, and his feet dragged along and dragged the rest of him down. This was a sure death act, a circus act, but after all they might send a telegram after the train and search the cars. After all, they would have missed him in the camp compound by now. He could not straighten out. He could not raise his head. He clung to the ties. He closed his eyes, ready for death. The accelerated clicking of the last cars, then lovely silence. The fugitive opened his eyes and rolled over. All he could see was the red light of the departing train. Freedom! But that was not yet salvation. Freedom was freedom. But he had neither documents nor money. He was dressed in camp rags, and he was doomed. Swollen and torn, somehow he managed to get to a station, and there mingled with a recently arrived Leningrad train. Evacuated semi-corpses were being led by the hand and fed hot food at the station. But that would not have saved him either, except that in the train he found a dying friend and took his documents, and he knew all about his past too. They were all sent to a place near Saratov, and for several years, until the war was over, he lived there on a poultry farm. And then he was seized with a longing to see his daughter, and went off to find her. He looked for her in Nalchik, in Armavir, and he found her in Uzhgorod. During this time, she had married a border guard. She had believed her father happily dead and buried, and now she listened to his story with horror and revulsion. Although she was quite devout in her civic conscientiousness, she nevertheless retained shameful vestiges of kinship, and she did not denounce her father, but merely drove him from her door. There were no other relatives of the old man left. He lived a meaningless existence, wandering like a nomad from city to city. He became a dope addict. In Baku he smoked hashish and was picked up by an ambulance, and while under the influence of the drug gave his right name, though when he came to he gave the name under which he had been living. It was one of our Soviet hospitals, which certainly couldn't treat him without first establishing his identity. A comrade was summoned from state security, and in 1952, 10 years after his escape, the old man got 25 years. It was this that gave him the happy chance to tell his own story in prison cells, and thus to enter history. Sometimes the subsequent life of a successful fugitive was more dramatic than the escape itself. That is how it must have been with Sergei Andreevich Shebatariov, who has already been mentioned more than once in this book. In 1914, he became an employee of the Chinese Eastern Railroad, the KVZHD. In February 1917, he became a Bolshevik. In 1929, during the period of the KVZHD hostilities, he was imprisoned in a Chinese prison. And in 1931, he and his wife, Yelena Prokofievna, and his sons, Gennady and Viktor, returned to their homeland. The fatherland then operated in its usual way. Within a few days, he himself was arrested, his wife went insane, his sons were turned over to different orphanages, and were given new patronymics and surnames, even though they well remembered their own and objected. At first, Shebatariov was given only 3 years by the Far Eastern Troika of the Ogpu, another Troika, because of their inexperience, but soon he was seized again, tortured and resentenced 10 years without the right of correspondence. What was there for him to write about now? And even confinement under intensified guard during the revolutionary holidays. The severity of this sentence unexpectedly helped him. In 1934, he was moved to Karlag, where he worked on building a railroad to Mointi. While there, during the May holidays of 1936, he was confined in the penalty isolator, and they threw in with him the free employee, Avtonom Vasilievich Chupin, under the same conditions as himself. Whether he was drunk or sober isn't clear, but at any rate, Chebotaryov managed to filch his 3-month identification certificate, which had expired 6 months earlier and which had been issued by his village Soviet. This certificate virtually obliged him to escape. And on May the 8th, Chebatariov left the Mointy camp, dressed in civilian clothes, without a scrap of camp clothing on him or with him, and with 2 half-liter bottles in his pockets, like a typical drunk, except that they held not vodka but water. Ahead of him stretched the salt marsh steppes. Twice he fell into the hands of Kazakhs who were on their way to work on the railroad, but since he knew a little Kazakh, I played on their religious feelings, and they let me go. Religion can have its uses even for an atheist. I affirmed earlier that Orthodox communists did not make escape attempts. Chebatariov was not one, but he was not entirely devoid of materialism either. I imagine that among the Kazakhs, the recollection of the Budeni repression of 1930 was still very much alive because they were good to him. Things wouldn't be like that in 1950. At the western edge of Lake Balkhash, he was detained by a security operations post of Karlag. Taking his document, they asked him to give all sorts of information about himself and his relatives, and the supposed Chupin answered correctly from memory. Here again he had a lucky accident. Without such lucky accidents, people probably get caught. The head of the operations group came into the dugout, and Chupin beat him to the draw. "Hey, Nikolai, how are you? Don't you recognize me?" This split-second calculation was based on facial wrinkles and a contest in remembering faces. "I recognize you all right, but if you recognize me, I'm a goner." "No, I don't recognize you." "Well, how about that? We were traveling on a train together. Your name is Naidyonov, and you were telling me how you met Olya at the station at Sverdlovsk. You met in a train compartment, and after that you got married." It was all true. Naidyonov was astonished. They had a smoke together, and they let the fugitive go. "Oh, you blue caps, not for nothing do they teach you to keep silent. You must not give in to the human impulse to frankness. You told this story not in a railroad car, but when you were on an assignment at the tree nursery of Karlag a year before, and you told it to the prisoners just like that, out of foolishness. And you could never have remembered all the mugs of those who listened to the story. And in all likelihood he had told this story on a train, too, more than once. It was the kind of story to tell on trains. And Chebotaryov's bold play was based on that. Joyfully, Chupin went farther along the highway to Chu Station, past the lake and on south. For the most part he travelled at night and hid in the high reeds whenever automobile headlights approached. During the day he lay down in them. There were reed jungles there. There were fewer and fewer operations men about. At that time the archipelago had not yet cast its metastases into those areas. But soon afterward the Korean exiles were sent there, and later the Germans, and then all the nations. 17 years later I ended up there myself. He had bread and sugar with him, and he made them last, and for 5 days he went along without any water at all. After 125 miles of walking, he reached the station and got on a train. And then began his poisoned years. Because Chebatariov couldn't risk settling down or staying too long in one place. That same year, several months later, he ran into his own camp godfather in the city park in Frunze. But that was in passing. It was a festive occasion with music and girls, and the godfather failed to recognize him. He had to leave the job he had found. The senior bookkeeper questioned him and guessed the urgent reasons, but turned out to be a Solovki veteran himself. He had to move on. At first he would not take the risk of seeking out his family, but afterward he worked out how to. He wrote to a woman cousin in Ufa, "Where are Lena and the children? Guess who is writing you? Don't tell her yet." And the return address was some kind of Zirabulak station, a man named Chupin. And the cousin replied, "The children are lost, and your wife is in Novosibirsk." Then Chebatariov asked her to go to Novosibirsk to tell his wife, but only face to face, that her husband had reappeared and wanted to send money. The cousin went, and now his own wife wrote to him. She was in a psychiatric hospital. Her passport had been lost. She had to get through 3 months of forced labor and she couldn't receive money sent to general delivery. His heart leapt. He had to go to her. And her husband sent her an insane telegram. Meet me on train such and such, car such and such. The heart is ever defenseless against emotion, but it is not, praise God, immune to premonitions. These premonitions so played on his mind while he was en route that he got off the train 2 stations before Novosibirsk and hitched a ride in a passing automobile. Having checked his luggage at the baggage room, he went recklessly to his wife's address. He knocked. The door was open, and there was no one in the house. This first coincidence was an ill omen. The landlord had spent the whole day on guard in order to warn him about the ambush waiting for him, but at that very moment had gone out to get water. He went on in. His wife was not there. On a cot lay a Czechist, covered with his coat and snoring loudly. The second coincidence was a benign omen. Chebotaryov fled. At that moment he was hailed by the landlord, a fellow acquaintance from the KVZHD, not yet arrested. Apparently his son-in-law was a security man, and had brought the telegram home himself and shaken it in front of Chebotaryov's wife. "This rat of yours, he's running right into our hands of his own accord." They had gone to the train and hadn't found him. The second security man had left for a moment, and this other had lain down to rest. Nonetheless, Chebotaryov managed to get hold of his wife, and they went several stations down the line in a car and got on a train to Uzbekistan. In Leninabad, they registered their marriage again. That is, without divorcing Chebotaryov, she now married Chupin. But they could not make up their minds to live together. They sent inquiries in every direction in her name in an attempt to find the children, but in vain. And that was the sort of separated and tormented life they led before the war. In 1941, Chupin was called out for military service and became a radio operator in the 61st Cavalry Division. On one occasion he was careless and called cigarettes and matches by their Chinese names as a joke. In what normal country could something like that arouse suspicion, merely because a man knew some foreign words? In our country, it did, and the stoolies were right there. And political commissar Sokolov, security officer of the 219th Cavalry Regiment, was questioning him within the hour. "Where did you learn Chinese?" "Chupin." "Only those 2 words." "Did you serve on the KVZHD? Service abroad is immediately viewed as a grave sin. The security officer also set the stoolies on him, but they found nothing. So, just to be certain, he arrested him under 5810 anyway, because he did not believe the Sovinform Bureau communiques. Because he had said that the Germans had more equipment, as if everyone had not seen that with their own eyes. Well, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Court-martial. Death sentence. And Chebotaryov was so fed up with life in the fatherland, he didn't even petition for mercy. But the state needed working hands, so he got 10 years plus 5 muzzled. Once again, he was back in his native home. He served, with time off for work, 9 years. And there was yet another chance encounter. In camp, another Zek, N.F. blank V., called him over to a far corner of the upper bunks and there asked him quietly, "What's your name?" "Avtonom Vasilich." "And what province were you born in?" "Tumen." "What district?" "What village Soviet?" Chebotaryov Chupin gave all the correct answers and heard, "You're lying. I worked on the same locomotive as Avtonom Chupin for 5 years. I know him as well as I know myself. Was it you who swiped his documents one day in May 1936? Now that's the kind of invisible underwater anchor a fugitive can rip open his belly on. What novelist would be believed if he were to think up an encounter like that? By that time, Chebotaryov again wanted to survive, and warmly shook that good man's hand when the latter said, "Don't be afraid, I won't go to the Godfather, I'm not a bastard." And thus it was that Chebotaryov served out his second term as Chupin. But to his misfortune, his last camp was a top-secret one, one of that group of atomic projects, Moscow 10, Tura 38, Sverdlovsk 39, and Chelyabinsk 40. They were engaged in separating uranium-radium ores, and construction was proceeding according to Kurchatov's plans, and the construction chief was Lieutenant General Tkachenko, who was subordinate only to Stalin and Beria. Every quarter the Zeks had to renew their pledges of non-disclosure. But this was not the real trouble. The real trouble was that those released were not allowed to return home. The released prisoners were sent off in a large group in September 1950 to the Kolyma. Only there were they relieved of convoy and declared to be a particularly dangerous special contingent. They were dangerous because they had helped make the atomic bomb. How can one really keep up with all this and describe it? Chapters and chapters are necessary. There were tens of thousands of similar ones scattered all over the Kolyma. Look through the Constitution. Look through the codes. What do they say about special contingents? Well, at least he could send for his wife now. She came to him at the Maldiak goldfields, and from there they began to seek their sons again. But the replies were all negative. No, not listed here. Stalin kicked the bucket, and the old folks moved from the Kolyma to the Caucasus to warm their bones. Things eased up, though slowly. And in 1959, their son Viktor, a Kiev lathe operator, decided to get rid of his hateful new name and declared himself to be the son of the enemy of the people, Chebotaryov. And a year later, his parents found him. And now the father's problem was to regain the name of Chebotaryov himself. Thrice rehabilitated, by then he could no longer be charged for the escape. He came out into the open. His fingerprints were sent to Moscow for comparison. The old man got back his peace of mind only when all three of them were issued passports in the name of Chebotaryov. And his daughter-in-law also became Chebotaryov. But a few years later he wrote to me that he already regretted having found Viktor. He abuses his father as a criminal and the source of all his misfortunes and waves away the rehabilitation certificates. A fake. And now the old man has fallen silent. I fear he may have died. And his elder son, Gennady, never has been found. From all the cases I have reported, it is clear that even a successful escape still couldn't bring freedom, but merely a life constantly oppressed and threatened. This was very well understood by some of the fugitives, by those who in the camps had succeeded in breaking away from the fatherland politically, by those, too, who lived by the ignorant, illiterate principle of just living. And it was not altogether rare to find among the fugitives some, in case of failure they had their answer ready, "We escaped in order to go to the Central Committee and ask to have our cases reopened," whose purpose was escape to the West, and who considered only that kind of escape complete. These escapes are the hardest of all to talk about. Those who did not make it are in the damp earth. Those who were caught again are silent. Those who left in some cases surfaced in the West, but in some cases because of someone left behind, are still silent. There were rumors that in Chukotka some Zeks captured a plane and seven of them flew to Alaska. But what I think is, they merely tried to seize one, and their plan failed. All these cases will continue to languish in secrecy for a long time to come, and grow old, and lose their relevance, just like this manuscript, and like everything truthful written in our country. Here is one such case, and once again, human memory has failed to preserve the name of the heroic fugitive. He was from Odessa, and in his civilian profession he was a mechanical engineer, and in the army, a captain. He finished the war in Austria and served in the occupation forces in Vienna. He was arrested in 1948 on the basis of a denunciation, and was charged and sentenced under Article 58 to 25 years, as was the norm by then. He was sent off to Siberia, to a camp located 180 miles from Taishet, in other words, far from the main line of the Trans-Siberian. He very soon began to weaken at logging, but he retained the will to fight for life and his memory of Vienna.
And from there, yes, from there, he succeeded in escaping to Vienna.
Incredible. Their logging sector was bordered by a cut, which was kept under surveillance from small watchtowers. On the chosen day, he had a bread ration with him at work. He felled a thickly branched pine across the cut, and beneath its branches crawled to its top. It wasn't tall enough to span the entire cut, but continuing to crawl, he made it across successfully. He took an axe with him. It was summer. He made his way through the taiga and wind-fallen woods. The walking was very difficult, but on the other hand, he didn't run into anyone for a whole month. Tying up the sleeves and collar of his shirt, he caught fish in it and ate them raw. He collected cedar nuts, mushrooms, and berries. Half dead, he nonetheless managed to get to the Trans-Siberian trunk line and happily went to sleep in a haystack. He was roused by voices. They were picking up the hay with pitchforks and had already found him. He was fagged out and prepared neither to run away nor to put up a fight. And he said, "Well, all right, take me. Turn me in. I'm a fugitive." There stood a railroad track walker and his wife, and the track walker said to him, "Oh, come on now, we are Russians. Just sit there and don't give yourself away." They went off. But the fugitive didn't believe them. They were, after all, Soviet people. They had to denounce him. And he crawled off into the woods. From the edge of the forest, he watched and saw the track walker return, bringing clothing and food. That evening, the fugitive walked along the track, and at a forest whistle stop, boarded a freight train, jumping off before morning and going into the forest for the day. Night after night, he moved on in this way, and when he grew stronger, he even got off at every stop, hiding in the foliage or walking on ahead, getting in front of the train, and then jumping on it again while it was moving. That way he risked dozens of times losing an arm, a leg, his head. That was how he paid for the few easy glides of the pen of the stoolie who had turned him in. But on one occasion, just before reaching the Urals, he changed his rule and went to sleep on a flat car carrying logs. He was wakened by a kick and a lantern shining in his eyes, and a demand for "documents." "Just a minute." He rose, and with one blow knocked the guard off the car and jumped off the other side, and onto the head of another guard. He knocked that one off his feet and managed to make his getaway under the nearby trains. Outside the station, he boarded a train while it was moving. He decided to bypass Sverdlovsk by walking around it, and in the suburbs plundered a trade stall, got clothes for himself, put three suits on, and collected some food. At one station, he sold one of the suits and bought a ticket from Chelyabinsk to Orsk and Central Asia. No, he knew where he was going, to Vienna. But he had to cover his tracks and let the pursuit die down. A Turkmen, chairman of a collective farm, met him at the bazaar, took him to work on the farm even though he had no documents, and his hands justified his calling as a mechanical engineer. He repaired all the farm machinery. After several months, he took his pay and went to Krasnovodsk, near the border. After the train left Mary, a patrol came along, checking documents. At this point, our mechanical engineer went out on the car platform, opened the door, hung on to the toilet window, where they could not see him from inside because of the frosted glass, and only the toe of one shoe remained to support him and enable him to get back on the step. The patrol failed to notice the toe of a shoe in the corner of the door frame, and went on into the next car. And so the awful moment passed. Having crossed the Caspian Sea without incident, the fugitive got on a train going from Baku to Shepetovka, and from there he made for the Carpathians. With great caution, he started to make his way across the mountainous border at a remote, steep, forested place. But still the border guards caught him. How much had he had to sacrifice, to suffer, to invent, and to endure since his Siberian camp, since that first felled pine tree? And right at the very end, everything was wrecked in one instant. And his strength left him, just as it had back there in the haystack at Taishet, and he couldn't resist any longer, nor lie, and in a final fury he merely shouted, "All right, take me, you executioners! Take me, you are stronger! Who are you? A fugitive from the camps! Take me!" But the border guards acted rather strangely. They blindfolded him, took him into a dugout, and there unbound his eyes and questioned him again. And suddenly it emerged that they were friends, Banderists, Ukrainian nationalist partisans. Fie, fie, educated readers will frown and wave their hands at me. Well, you've certainly picked some character. He regarded the Banderists as friends. A real rotten fruit, that one. Well, all I can do is spread my hands myself. That's how he was. That's how he was when he escaped. That's what the camps had made of him. These camp people, as I can tell you, live on the basis of the swinish principle, existence determines consciousness, not by what the newspapers say. To camp inmates, friends are those with whom they were tormented in camp, and enemies are those who put the dogs on their trail. Lack of conscientiousness. And so they embraced. The Banderists still had their own border crossings at that time, and they gently led him across. And so there he was in Vienna again, but this time in the American zone, and submissive still to that enticing materialist principle, and not forgetting for one moment his bloody death camp. He no longer sought work as a mechanical engineer, but instead went to the American authorities to unburden his soul. And he began to work for them in some capacity. But it is a human trait to relax one's vigilance as soon as the danger is past. He planned to send some money to his parents in Odessa, and to do that he had to exchange dollars for Soviet money. Some Jewish businessman invited him to his apartment in the Soviet zone of Vienna to make the deal. People used to shuttle back and forth all the time, paying no attention to the zones, but he should never have gone into the Soviet zone. He went, however, and was captured at the apartment of the money changer. Now, this is a very Russian story of how superhuman feats are strung on, and then thrown away for a glass of vodka. Sentenced to death, and in a cell of the Soviet prison in Berlin, he told the whole story to another officer and engineer, Anikin. This Anikin had himself been both in a German POW camp and on the verge of death in Buchenwald, and had been freed by the Americans, taken to the Soviet zone of Germany, and left there temporarily to assist in dismantling factories, and had run off to West Germany and was engaged in building a hydroelectric power station near Munich when he was kidnapped by the Soviet intelligence service. He was blinded with headlights and pushed into an automobile. And what was it all for? So that he could hear the story of the Odessa mechanical engineer and preserve it for us? So as to attempt fruitlessly to escape from Ekibastutz twice? About which there will be more in part 5. And then be killed in the penalty lime factory. Now, that is predestination. Those are the twists of fate. And how can we then discern the meaning of one individual human life? We have not yet described the group escapes, and there were many of them too. They say that in 1956 a whole small camp escaped near Montchegorsk. The history of all the escapes from the archipelago would be a list too long to be read, too long to be leafed through. And any one person who wrote a book solely about escapes, to spare his reader and himself, would be forced to omit hundreds of cases. Chapter 15. Punishments. Among the many joyous renunciations brought us by the New World were the renunciation of exploitation, the renunciation of colonies, the renunciation of obligatory military service, the renunciation of secret diplomacy, secret assignments and transfers, the renunciation of secret police, the renunciation of divine law, and many, many other fairy tale renunciations in addition. But not, to be sure, a renunciation of prisons. They didn't break down the walls, but merely inserted a new class content inside them. However, there was an unqualified renunciation of punishment blocks, that pitiless torture which could have been conceived only by the hate-filled minds of bourgeois prison keepers. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.